Right around the corner on a brand new daddy on board, let's talk psychotropic drugs for your struggling student, the wanderlust on the autism spectrum, and the leading candidate for Mother of the Year. All this and a whole lot more coming up next on DOB 107. Welcome, boys and girls, to Daddy on Board 107, a podcast recited into a microphone and recorded by the oft-times malfunctioning Audacity software and then published for you by me. I'm your host, Mike Quackenbush, a parent, podcaster, and professional wrestler, and I will bring to you today stories from the parentosphere about things you may need to know, including this story about Adderall. You may know that Adderall is a powerful prescription medicine that is often used to boost focus and impulse control in children specifically suffering from attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD as it is commonly known. However, a number of doctors out there, like Dr. Michael Anderson, for example, who works out of Cherokee County just north of Atlanta, has begun prescribing this for children regardless of whether or not he feels they have ADHD. In fact, he's gone on to say that he thinks the disorder might just be an excuse. And in fact, he uses it as an excuse to prescribe the pills to children whose real ill, in his opinion, are poor academic performances. He specifically targets those that go to inadequate schools. Now, Dr. Anderson is one of the most outspoken proponents of an idea that is gaining interest among some physicians. They're prescribing these stimulants like Adderall to struggling students that are in school starved of extra money, not necessarily because he believes they have ADHD, but just to boost their academic performance. As I said, Adderall in specific is designed to boost focus and impulse control in children. Now, it's not clear whether or not Dr. Anderson really represents a new trend that's forming, but experts note, as wealthy students who are able to abuse stimulants to raise already good grades in college or high school, on the other side of the equation, there are these medications which are being used in low-income elementary school children that have faltering grades to help their parents and to help the children succeed as a result. Quote, we as a society have been unwilling to invest in very effective non-pharmaceutical interventions for these children and their families. We are effectively forcing local community psychiatrists to use the only tool at their disposal, which is psychotropic medications. End quote. That's from a child mental health service researcher at Washington State University. Now, Dr. Nancy Rappaport, who's a child psychiatrist from Massachusetts, who works primarily with lower income children in their schools, adds, quote, we are seeing this more and more. We are using a chemical straitjacket instead of doing things that are just as important to also do, sometimes more, end quote. Now, Dr. Anderson, who fancies himself a bit of a social justice thinker, sees this as a method of evening the scales because these children, who may not necessarily have ADHD but are prescribed Adderall anyway by him, see that the children who have these academic problems are simply mismatched with their environment, as he puts it. That is to say, they are square pegs trying to be forced into round holes that public education represents. Because these lower-income families can rarely afford behavior-based therapies like tutoring, family counseling, etc., the medication becomes the most reliable and pragmatic way to help aim this student toward success. A number of parents who have taken advantage of this note that Medicaid covers almost every penny of the related costs. And some experts see little harm in a responsible physician using ADHD medications to help struggling students. Others, even among the many like Dr. Rappaport, who praise the use of stimulants as treatment for classic ADHD, fear that doctors are exposing children to unwarranted physical and psychological risks because reported side effects of this drug include growth suppression, increased blood pressure, and in some rare cases, psychotic episodes. So obviously, you can see why some parents see an upside to this, but I want to point out that it is exactly these kinds of medications, and Adderall is not the only one. That just happens to be the one that's noted in this piece that's been out there. The New York Times published this, by the way, about a week ago, is that there are no long-term studies about the real long-term effects on developing brains of these psychotropic medications. And so, of course, you always want to do your due diligence to the very best of your ability, keeping in mind, as I just said, that there are no long-term studies about the overall effects of these on developing minds, if this sounds like something that you may be considering in the meanwhile. At least one of the other parents, incidentally, that spoke about this positively, incidentally, most of the parents who spoke out about this spoke about positive effects that they saw in their children, mentioned a different prescription drug called Concerta. In any event, really in-depth article and lots more information. If you want to go and discover more about this topic yourself, head over to nytimes.com in their health section. This piece was entitled Attention Disorder or Not, Pills to Help in School. That and everything contained in today's episode are made possible only thanks to our friends over at Cobra.com. They just released, in time for the holidays, incidentally, you've heard us talk about it here on the Grizzly Productions Network, the brand new Cobra Vedetta Ultimate Detection System. This is just out and it's designed to maximize driver comfort, safety, and situational awareness of your entire driving environment. It reduces the risk of accidents and traffic violations and makes a great Christmas gift, does the Vedetta. Check it out over at Cobra.com. Okay, an important story here for those parents out there that are coping with any variety of developmental disorders that might fall onto the autism spectrum. But before I dive into the story, I want to clarify something for you, as there was a specific use of the word elopement in this piece, and they used the term over and over again, that did not exactly match up with my own connotation of the word. They are using elope, the verb here, specifically to refer to the activity of leaving without the permission of parents. All right? So keep that in mind here. This was broken by USA Today with this eye-catching headline, "Nearly half of children with autism wander from safety." In a sample of 1,200 children with autism, 49% of them had eloped at least once after age 4. More than a quarter of them went missing long enough to cause their family some concern. Now, by comparison, only about 13% of their siblings without autism ever wandered off after age 4. Developmentally, this is the age when such behavior becomes less common, according to a new study published in the journal Pediatrics. Among children with autism who did go missing for a period of time, 65% had close calls with traffic, 24% were put in danger of drowning. Pediatrician Paul Law, the senior author of the study and director of the Interactive Autism Network Project, said this, quote, "Elopement is one of the very few problems in autism that is life-threatening. It is probably one of the leading, if not the leading, cause of death in children with autism," he says, end quote there. The design of this study did not pick up deaths that resulted from elopement, but researchers did track media reports. Law goes on to further clarify, quote, "It's very predictable every few months that a child dies due to wandering, be it from drowning, a traffic accident, exposure, or other events related to getting themselves into some unsafe place without supervision," end quote. The study also finds that elopement attempts peak at age 5 for children with autism spectrum disorders. From age 4 to 7, about 46% of children with autism wander away, which is 4 times the rate of those without autism. From ages 8 to 11, 27% of children with autism wander away. From ages 12 to 17, about 12% of them did. Children who wandered had more severe autism symptoms and had lower intellectual and communication scores than those who did not. The most common locations from which children eloped were their own home, another home, a store, classroom, or school. Now, obviously, the risks here are quite grave for some of the reasons already detailed there, the tendency to wander into traffic. And those in the community studying this, the reason they were trying to get away from, if you're curious why they're overusing the term elopement as opposed to wandering, is because wandering tends to conjure a thought of, I guess, aimlessness in people's minds. And the people that put this study out were very specific in saying, no, that elopement is different. They are simply leaving without their parents' permission. For example, one of the children that they studied attempted to walk to a Chinese restaurant that the family had visited weeks prior, despite the fact that it was miles away. So it is often because they do have a very specific goal in mind that they leave. You know, their diminished cognitive ability and things like that, of course, are behind making decisions like that. So they aren't wandering or roaming aimlessly. However, that doesn't in any way diminish the fact that they're jeopardizing themselves. They're ending up in unsafe places. Findings from this study then were used by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, which have recently created a medical diagnostic code for wandering as a condition of autism, which is an important first step in efforts to get preventative support and services. Now, equally important to this movement, which is basically they're looking to create an autism alert warning system, which is similar to the Amber Alert, right? You might know that in the event that a child is abducted, an Amber Alert is issued. However, an Amber Alert would not really be appropriate in these types of situations, and therefore the push is on to create an autism alert warning system that might be able to help parents and mobilize resources in the event of a child elopement, an escape without permission, to be quite clear. So important information there. If you want to read that, all the findings that were put out by the Interactive Autism Network Project, of course, you can look them up online. They are IANproject.com if you want, or the latest edition of Pediatrics has that new study that was just published on this topic. Who's up for Mother of the Year? How about Elizabeth Escalona? Have you heard this name? She has been all over the news this week and has been for quite a few weeks, but especially right now as a sentencing hearing for her is going on down in Dallas, Texas. The 23-year-old mother of five is up against a potential 45-year sentence in prison. She has just in the last day, in fact, as I'm recording this, she is on the stand right now in Dallas pleading for leniency. And why is that? Well, I'll tell you. Police have asserted that she has attacked her 2-year-old daughter due to potty training problems. She superglued her daughter's hands to the wall and then beat her so badly she suffered bleeding on her brain. As prosecutors have shown her images of what she's done to her daughter, just in the last 24 hours during the sentencing hearing, she claims not to recall having done these things and has also told those in attendance that she is not the monster that she once was. A really bizarre and very disturbing case, to be sure, as this is going on here. Some testimony, including some from a former child abuse specialist at Children's Medical Center of Dallas, Dr. Amy Barton, spoke out about her daughter, Elizabeth Escalona's daughter, not Dr. Barton's daughter, Jocelyn, being hospitalized for about a week with injuries including bleeding on her brain, a fractured rib, bruising all over her body, and others that were likely caused by direct blows. Ultimately, it was thanks to Escalona's mother, the grandmother of Jocelyn, her intervention when she observed Jocelyn face down on the floor of Escalona's home or apartment, it's not really clear, taking shallow breaths, she removed her from the home. The disturbing, I mean, obviously what's happened to her 2-year-old daughter, she's the mother of five, this is just one of her five children, obviously that is extremely disturbing, but so too has just been the method in which Escalona, and I guess maybe her defense, has conducted themselves as all of this has been going on and continues to go on right now. This is a breaking story here on the Dob, as she really just kind of claims to remember nothing and is dissociating herself from what's happened. They asked her, you know, why she superglued her daughter's hands to the wall. She's unable really to admit to anything other than having repeatedly said at the time that she was taken into custody to the police that I take the blame. She was unhelpful and uncooperative, even as doctors were racing to try and save her daughter's life, in coming forth with any concrete information that could have assisted them during that process. just repeating the phrase, I'm taking the blame, over and over and over again. There's certainly been a bit of a media whirlwind around this, as you can imagine, and updates are constantly coming out through all the major news sources about this. A very unfortunate case. I assure you, if I have more information next week on the Dub, I will bring it to you, but I can safely say that thus far, she's the leading candidate for Mother of the Year here. I don't know what kind of prize we're giving away for that. It might be me making a stern face, or maybe I show up at your house. Maybe that's it. I show up at your house, and I'm not pleasant toward you. Maybe that's what we do. So yeah, there's that feel-good story of the week. All right, let's talk about something we all enjoy, and that is dessert. And certainly this piece is relevant to me because I, on at least two separate occasions, have used dessert as a motivation to try and get my three-year-old son, Elliot, to finish his dinner. Well, a new book called Little Sugar Addicts, which really isn't all that new. I don't know why I called it that. Had some very interesting information about the way children are sensitive to sugar. Little Sugar Addicts puts forth this idea that, quote, certain people are born with an imbalance in three parts of their brain and body chemistry. They have low serotonin, that's the chemical that quiets the brain and helps with saying no to things, low beta endorphins, that's like a painkiller in the brain, and volatile blood sugar. These three disturbances set them up to react profoundly to the drug-like effects of sugar, end quote. So you need to pay attention when your child consumes sugar, because a child who exhibits a negative response to too much sugar needs to have less and probably should not regularly be given dessert. A child who eats well on their own all day can probably have a sweet snack more often than a child who isn't getting enough nutrients in their body. Proteins, healthful fats, these slow down the effect of sugar and simple carbohydrates. So a child that eats well throughout the day might be less affected by any sugar that is consumed. Dessert now, of course, can be used as a bargaining chip for getting children to eat their dinner, to eat more nutritious things, right? Like, I think we can all relate to that experience of, oh, if you don't eat all your vegetables, then you can't have dessert, things like that. I don't think this is all that uncommon, or at least I'm saying that out loud to justify my own behaviors, okay? Certainly it's tempting for us as parents to rely on this as like a bribe or an incentive to get the, why is it always broccoli, but it is, to get the broccoli down. But this sets up an unhealthy message that dinner is dreadful while dessert should be desired. You also want to be very careful about raising a child's blood sugar before bedtime because this will inhibit a child's ability to fall asleep. And when the resulting sugar drop then occurs, the body releases adrenaline, so the child might experience a disruption in healthful sleep. I don't know why I botched that. That was adrenaline. Adrenaline. That came out of my mouth all weird there in that last segment. Anyway, another thing that's really, really important to impart to children, and this is true not just of children, this is true of adults as well, is that you only need to eat when you're hungry. The problem, of course, is that desserts can be very tempting. And so even though we aren't hungry, or because it's being handed as a reward, for example, for completing the consumption of your otherwise healthy meal, even if the child isn't still hungry or truly in the mood for something sweet, they will consume it anyway. And that can be very difficult. And I know that's another thing that I am very, very guilty of, because sometimes even when I am full, if a dessert is presented, I will eat it anyway. It's because it's delicious. I want the dessert in my belly. And that is why I have developed what is known as the ice cream belly. That's what I have. Anyway, so good information there that I wanted to pass along to you about that, about the way in which we use dessert. Now, when we return, I'll tell you about some things I read in the blogosphere, and I might even read your little victories, okay? You've probably heard that age-old proverb that the lifeblood of America are its fast food employees. And this is false. It's actually truckers. It's the truck driving industry that keeps us alive. And I know this podcast is very popular with truck drivers, as are all the podcasts on the Grizzly Productions Network. Well, truckers, if you're looking for CB radios, GPS navigation, the most state-of-the-art driving accessory equipment, you need to go and see our friends, the real American heroes, Cobra Electronics. They're over at Cobra.com. And the goods they make are for a wide variety of folks, including people like me. Because while I'm not a truck driver, I am a frequent road tripper, and their Cobra Eye radar system, which gives me up-to-date, real-time driving hazard information, has indubitably made me a safer and more alert driver. Can do the same for you. They make great gifts for other people, and when gift-giving comes around, make sure you check out their Cobra Tag system, an ingenious two-way locator that ensures that you'll never misplace your keys or your smartphone or any other Cobra Tag protected item ever again. They've got solutions to make your life easier. Don't fear them in spite of their snaky iconography. Go over there right now and see our long-standing show sponsors and great friends over at Cobra.com. I wanted to share with you the message of a short but poignant blog that I read this past week by Heather Shook. She's the CEO and founder of Glamalife and all the related brands when she's not designing hip baby clothes for her Glamajama line. She blogs about her experience as a mother of three. She talked a little bit this week about encouraging her son to overcome some of the obstacles he faced at a local like rock climbing place where they enjoy going, evidently, and about the need for grit. She believes that grit is a success factor for kids. And she points to a number of studies that do just that, and I'm not going to bore you with the statistics and other information there. But she puts forth the idea that we need to dispose of the mantra, do your best, because while it is good intention, she feels it serves as a free pass to settle for good enough. She's done away with do your best in her household, and she's accepted the mantra of challenge yourself. She points out what's the very worst that could have happened in this recent case, where she encouraged her son to try and climb higher than he ever had before on the rock wall where they like to let off a little steam. He was afraid to try and go further, but he was encouraged by his mother and was able to do it. And what would have been the worst that could have happened? Well, he could have confirmed his suspicion. He might have failed that he was unable to do it, which is hardly a life-ending thing. And at least he would have felt good about himself for trying. What's the best that could happen here? Well, it's that he achieved something that he once considered to be impossible, and therefore a door of possibility is opened wide. She happens to think that the rewards here far outweigh the risks, and puts forth the idea that we need to always make certain that we encourage our kids not to just settle for good enough, but to always challenge themselves. And I kind of like that. I like that idea a lot. And I thought it was a good blog, very short as well, which I appreciate, because I have to read a lot of stuff for this show. KJ Dell'Antonia, who blogs for the Motherload section of the NYTimes.com website, posted up a piece just this past week entitled Coming Out as a Boy Scout Has a Price. Now, National Coming Out Day is actually, I guess it's today. I didn't realize that. So today is National Coming Out Day, and I guess that's why this piece is timed the way that it is. In this piece, KJ talks about Ryan, a teenager whose mother has completed all the requirements to become an Eagle Scout. That is to say, Ryan has completed them, not the mother. She has, the mother, that is, has started a petition over on change.org. This petition's collected nearly 150,000 signatures as of this writing. And this petition is simply because the leadership of Troop 212, that's in the San Francisco Bay Area, found out when they discovered that Ryan was gay. The scoutmaster said he refused to sign the official paperwork designating Ryan as an Eagle Scout. It's easy to see, then, why some teens, particularly on a day like today, might feel like don't ask, don't tell is still the best way to be gay in certain communities. Now, unfortunately, while I can certainly appreciate the efforts of this mother and the 150,000-plus people that signed her petition, I happen to be of the opinion that the Boy Scouts simply aren't moved by this type of outcry. They are virtually ignorant of public opinion. They're really mired in some outdated rhetoric. And I say that to you as an Eagle Scout myself. There is an enormous amount of work that goes into it, not just for the Scout, but for the parents as well. I know this to be the case. And the fact that all of this has been completed by Ryan, and simply because of sexual orientation, they are refusing to recognize his achievement, is, in a word, detestable. Their behavior and stance on this type of thing, when scouting should really be an all-inclusive experience. I'm adamant in my opinion about that. There are certainly life lessons and experiences that the scouting experience provides to growing boys and young men out there that everyone should have the opportunity to experience. And the fact that certain people are denied that simply because of their orientation, I think, just to reiterate my stance, is detestable. I think in this age, and in fact, Ryan went on to create, incidentally, as part of a community service project, what he called a tolerance wall, obviously shows that his young mind is certainly far more open than the incredibly close-minded thought processes of those in charge of the scouting organization to this day. We've talked about this in the past, or I've spoken about it in the past here. It's really kind of like a monologue most of the time when I'm here by myself, that the stance that the scouts are taking on this, I think, is largely indefensible. And it's shameful in a way. Certainly, it is not with any pride that I regard my own rank as an Eagle Scout, not because I'm afraid of looking like a dork. That's never been an issue in my life. But because of things exactly like this, which really are quite shameful and cast the entire organization in a very, very negative light. And I can only hope, although certainly their track record seems to speak to the opposite, that the immense outpouring of support for this petition on change.org that was started by Ryan's mother will sway the leadership of Troop 212 to change their stance and give this boy, who obviously spent an enormous amount of time and work and effort and everything else in completing all of the requirements, the award that he is due. I think it would only be fair. And I thought, as a radical deviation from the way we usually wrap up the Daddy on Board podcast, this week I'd read your little victories to close the program. And so I will. These are your little parenting triumphs sent in to me via Twitter at the Daddy on Board, or posted up on our Facebook fan page, or even over on Google Plus, where apparently some people do hang out. This one came to me from the Lewis guy, who tweeted the Daddy on Board saying, "My wife went back to work part-time this week. Successfully left my 14-month-old daughter in Nana's care." And thanks for using hashtag Little Victories, the Lewis guy. That made it very easy for my underlings to find when surfing through Twitter. Raul Colon, a dad blogger and friend of the Daub, wrote this to me. He wrote, "Our daughter went to her first rock and science concert. And it's strange, as I don't know how often those two things come together. Were the artists Thomas Dolby and or They Might Be Giants? I don't know who else would have a rock and science concert, Raul. There's not enough information. You have to tell me more." Brent1992 wrote to me on Twitter writing, "My two-month-old is laughing and smiling already. Sign of a genius or class clown? Hashtag little victories." It could be both, Brent. It could be both. You'll be pleased to know. Thanks for sending in your little victories. If you send me some in the next week, I'm likely to read them on a podcast I'll make about 7 days from now that will be entitled Daddy on Board 108. Before I get around to that, I'll probably team up with my pal Clayton Morris. You know him from Fox and Friends on the Fox News Network. We make the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe every single week. This week, the 201st edition is due out. And then on the weekends, I team up with his wife, Natalie Morris, who's always up on the most current trending topics of Google and Twitter, and she schools me in these things on a program that we could only dare to call The Trending Show. So check out those podcasts, and then be back here in about a week's time for more of Daddy on Board. Adios, mis amigos.